Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
World Business Report from the BBC brings you the latest global business and finance news.
Let's have a look at big business and economic stories around today.
With energy prices soaring.
Rising energy prices are hurting every consumer worldwide.
And the cost of living rising.
Consumer behaviour is changing practically overnight.
We delve deeper into how the world's changing economy is affecting all our lives. Search for World Business Report wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 14 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 7th of February, these are our main stories. The Turkish president has declared a state of emergency across a large part of the country after Monday's earthquake that's left more than 5,000 people dead there and in Syria. We'll bring the latest on efforts to bring people out alive from the rubble.
We heard voices. Our children are in there. But what can we do? The building is already partially collapsed. We risked our lives, but there's nothing to do. There are no emergency workers, no soldiers, nobody.
We'll hear from Syria, where the hospitals are struggling to cope.
We received more than 300 injuries. A lot of those injuries are so complicated. They need a surgery, and our staff so limited. We have a limitation.
Also in this podcast, Russia's foreign minister is in Mali, part of Moscow's effort to spread its influence across Africa. What's in it for the people there? As we record this podcast, it is 36 hours since that powerful earthquake hit parts of Turkey and Syria, and the scale of the disaster seems to grow by the hour. Teams of rescuers, along with all the equipment they need, are arriving in southeastern Turkey from around the world. They need to work fast. At the moment, people trapped under collapsed buildings are able to send out texts, videos, voice notes and their live locations. But as the hours go by, the chance of pulling people out alive will drop off very quickly. More than 5,000 people are confirmed dead already. Standing amidst ruins of buildings covered in snow, these people in the central Turkish city of Malatya said the authorities had not come to help recover their relatives trapped under the rubble.
My in-laws' grandchildren are in there. We have been here for 2 days. We're devastated. Where is the state? Where have they been for the last 2 days? We're begging them. Let us do it. We can rescue them.
I've got two nephews in the wreckage behind me. Around 2 o'clock yesterday, this building collapsed. Thousands of people are currently under the rubble. The authorities won't let us save them ourselves, but they don't send anyone to help either.
Well, the situation in northern Syria seems even worse. According to local journalists, no international aid has managed to get into the rebel-held areas. We'll hear from there in a moment. And just before we came into the studio, we heard from our correspondent Anna Foster, who has reached one of the most devastated cities, Marash, near the epicentre of the first earthquake. She told us what she's seeing.
We were stuck in gridlock traffic with search and rescue teams, specialist equipment, things that they were desperately trying to get here. And it's taken them hours. And when you do arrive, you really do get a sense of the destruction and the devastation. We're not talking single collapsed buildings here. Some of the people behind me there, these are their homes. They have nowhere to go. They're pulling out some of the furniture and burning it to try and keep warm. Rescue workers are still on top of these piles of rubble, but there is just too much. There are too many collapsed buildings. There is too much for them to try and deal with the resources that they have at the moment. This has wiped out this city. And really, I can't imagine how long it will take to actually see the full extent of what has happened here.
I've also been speaking to another of our correspondents, Tom Bateman. He's in Iskenderun on the Mediterranean coast of Turkey.
Yeah, that noise is some heavy earth-moving equipment that's coming off the back of a lorry next to us at the moment. The point about this town that we've discovered is it's just one disaster layered on top of another here, because as we drove in, and you may have seen some of the pictures on social media or TV screens, there is an absolutely huge column of black smoke rising from the port here. Now, it's enveloping really a huge part of the town, slightly away from where we are, going over shattered tower blocks and descending over onto the snowy Taurus mountains behind us. And it is an apocalyptic scene, because when you arrive here at the other end of the center of the town, there are white plumes of smoke rising up from shattered buildings, I think one of which may be newly collapsed. And really every corner you seem to go around, you find more toppled buildings. And in the center, there's wasteland as the sun sort of shines through this smoky, smoggy scene. And there are children and families who have set up camp here from the homes that have been toppled. It's really the only place they're left to go. And what everyone is saying here is there is just no sign of any significant relief effort.
Tom, given where you are, and that's some way away from the epicentre of the first quake, I don't know, about 100 kilometres away, it seems that the area that's been affected, and really badly affected, is huge, isn't it? This is a massive operation of recovery for Turkey.
Yeah, I mean, this is an absolutely enormous area. We had Turkish officials saying this morning they think 13.5 million people are affected by this. That's in southern Turkey alone, so that's not counting northern Syria. So, yes, absolutely. I mean, we started this morning in Adana, which has been less severely hit, although, you know, one of the first things we came to was a 10-story building that had been flattened. Things are a bit better there. And so because the airport is there, is still functioning, that's serving as a relief hub for much of the region. But it doesn't take long. I mean, it was an hour and a half, I think, to drive here. Big fuel queues at gas stations on the way, which gives you a sense of, you know, how there is power outage, how there is already the sense of a potential fuel crisis for people. And once we finally got here, I mean, just seeing the scale of damage so suddenly was really very, very shocking. And, you know, people here are trying to take it in, and at the same time trying to work out how they are going to survive. I was talking to one woman who said that all they've been given so far is some bread and tomatoes. She gave that to her children and to her grandchildren. She had a very ill little boy, 6-year-old, who's on a couple of mattresses. They were given 2 duvets, she said, by government officials, but so far that's all they've had.
Tom, President Erdogan has just announced a state of emergency for 3 months. He's set aside hotels to act as shelters. But we're hearing on social media and elsewhere that people are very critical already of the response. I suppose that is inevitable, is it not? What are you hearing about the reaction from people about how this is being dealt with?
I'm having real problems hearing the question. I heard you talk about social media. I mean, I think one of the issues about communication here is to do with the numbers of people still trapped under the rubble. One survivor I spoke to this morning was terribly concerned about her own daughter, who was on the second floor of a building, a 10-story building that had collapsed. Now, we watched as the rescue workers had got down to clearing rubble to about the 6th floor, but really getting nowhere close to that. And we're getting all sorts of stories, particularly from Hatay in the south of the country, about how people are trying to carry out rescues by themselves with their bare hands. They can hear people, in some cases, calling for help, but they simply don't have the relief or the rescue effort or operation behind them to try and do that effectively.
Tom Bateman, and we'll be hearing again from Tom later in the podcast. Let's look now at how people are helping each other in Turkey. Beria Gucham is a restaurant owner and architect in Adana. She, along with a group of graduate volunteers, are trying to get assistance to people in Antakya, a city further south.
We have gathered together, raised some funds, and while I'm trying to buy supplies for field restaurant, a field kitchen out there, because apparently all the suppliers are down too in Antakya. Antakya is a very old town with 1.7 million people, and apparently 70% of the town has been destroyed. All the shops, all the wholesalers are closed at the moment, and these field kitchens are having troubles finding supplies. So I'm trying to load a lorry and send stuff out there. Everyone is pitching in. Everyone is trying to do their best.
Meanwhile, in the capital, Ankara, people are volunteering in large numbers to give blood. Victoria Craig is at a blood donation centre there.
Yeah, so the mood is a bit of optimism, a bit of, you know, just despair, really, over the disaster that has happened south of this country, south of the capital city here where I am, as you say, here in Ankara today. I'm at a Red Crescent blood donation center. Red Crescent is like the Red Cross here. And I was here about an hour and a half or so ago, and the line was around the little trailer that they have set up here, where people have been, you know, they waited hours just to give blood, just to help the people, you know, who might need it further south. And so I spoke to a couple of people who were in line. Some had waited, you know, this was their second day lining up. The first day they were too busy. They couldn't accept donations. And it's a bit of a mixed reaction here of what motivated people. But take a listen to what they had to say.
Honestly, it is very freezing here. But, you know, as a human being, we have to do our duty. We have to do our duty, yeah.
Well, it's a huge catastrophe. We were not prepared. And we need every possible help from all world.
And I think the thing there to point out, and this is a thing that strikes me every time I'm here, but it's just this spirit of wanting to pull together and to help each other out. It's really front and center today here in Ankara.
That was Victoria Craig. Let's hear from northern Syria now, where the rescue effort is being hampered by the impact of years of military and political conflict. Some of the territory is in rebel hands outside the control of President Assad's government forces. And in those areas, for years, the conflict has destroyed basic facilities, including hospitals. The Civilian Emergency Response Group, who operate in rebel areas, the White Helmets, said time was running out. And on the border with Turkey, we've heard how bad the situation is. Dr. Osama Saloon works at the Al-Hawa Hospital.
We received more than 300 injuries, 50 dead people. Actually, a lot of those injuries so complicated, they need a surgery. And our staff so limited. We have a limitation, resources by equipment. We have only the one CT machine. I think within an hour, maybe we'll be out of service. And the injuries are still coming to our hospital, and we have to deal with them. There is no way to refer these injuries to another hospital because all of the hospital completely occupied and some of the hospital out of service. We need medical staff to deal with these complicated injuries. And I think if nobody take care of those, they will lose their souls.
Our correspondent, Lise Doucette, told me more about the situation on and around the border.
There is a lack of everything across the border in northwest Turkey, in the last rebel-held enclave. It's not the only area to have been hit by this devastating earthquake, but it is one of the worst affected areas, where it is being described as a crisis within a crisis within a crisis, an area that's been whipped by the more than decade-long war, an area where there was already a dire humanitarian crisis. Only weeks ago, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres had warned that the some 4 million people living in the area of Idlib would not last the winter if the aid delivery did not improve. There is only one narrow road, one lifeline between Syria and Turkey, where the humanitarian agencies are allowed to deliver aid to that rebel area. That's because Russia has vetoed anything else. Russia, the most powerful ally of Syria's President al-Assad. Now that road, which is even more desperately needed, is choked with traffic, wrecked by the earthquake. And so there needs to be many, many more routes into there, but also into the northeast, which is largely controlled by Kurdish forces. And of course, all of the provinces of Syria in one way or another, some much less so, and those controlled by President Assad's forces were touched by this earthquake.
Could this be the moment when President Assad decides to allow humanitarian in from the south into the rebel-held areas, do you think?
That is what the government has always said. For them, it is a sovereignty issue. They don't want aid to come in directly to rebel-held areas without going through Syrian checkpoints, Syrian authorization. But of course, there's always the concern either that the aid which is needed in all parts of Syria, quite frankly, but not quite as badly as in Idlib, will be stopped. It is also because of the bitter hatreds between the opposition and the Syrian government that makes that a very treacherous route to take. But that may be one of the options which will have to be considered if any aid at all is to get in to that area. People have to remember that of those 4 million people, nearly half of that population have been pushed from their homes time and again, some as many as 10 times in the last decade of war. They were living in makeshift shelters, half-finished buildings, in tents, in flimsy tents. And the tragedy of the situation is such that today, the people who were living in tents are saying, in freezing cold temperatures, are saying, thank goodness we were living in a tent. Our tent is still safe, while the buildings, the half-finished buildings, collapsed.
That was Lise Doucette. So, staying on efforts to help people in Syria, let's hear from Emma Forster of the Norwegian Refugee Council.
Our teams are on the ground assessing the needs in different areas that we work in, while also trying to provide any basic assistance that we can. So helping to get people to collective shelters, provide food and water, and assist with the rescue efforts in any way that we can. In the camp settings, we're not hearing about them as much because we're hearing about a lot of damaged buildings that are collapsing, but also the situation for IDPs that are in the camps is also very severe because they were already the most vulnerable in the community and they're likely to be affected by this crisis due to the lack of appropriate shelters that they have, the increased capacity on the humanitarian response. So they're likely to be extremely affected by the earthquake. More resources urgently need to be mobilized, and including equipment, financial resources and expertise to help respond to the relief efforts. And it's important to remember that this is a crisis that has been going on for 12 years and the funding was already, it was already a massively underfunded response. And so now the needs are immediate and acute, but also that this is going to have a knock-on effect and take Syria back several steps in terms of recovery. So more resources are urgently needed.
Emma Forster of the Norwegian Refugee Council. Let's get some international response now. Speaking in Geneva, the head of the World Health Organization, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, expressed concern about the lack of information from some of the areas in the disaster zone.
Numbers do not tell us about the perilous situation that many families now face, having lost everything. We're especially concerned about areas where we do not yet have information.
Well, I put it to Paul Moss, our Europe regional editor, that comments like that from Mr. Ghebreyesus apply to most kinds of natural disasters, don't they?
Absolutely. I mean, that point at the end about the remote areas we haven't been hearing from, I mean, what disturbs me is we heard something very similar 24 hours ago and still not hearing anything. I can't help but be reminded of an analogy, if you can see this. When you do first aid courses, one of the things you learn is there may be someone screaming and shouting out, and instinctively everyone rushes towards them. Now, that person may be in trouble, but they are at least breathing. The person who's silent may need far quicker help. In this situation, we're obviously seeing these horrific pictures of these cities with these buildings collapsed. But out there in rural areas, there are villages completely cut off from any humanitarian aid, with very, very little in the way of medical support, and simple buildings which may have collapsed even more easily. A great deal of worry about what is going on there. But, of course, as Lise Doucette was suggesting, I mean, the place that there is a particular concern about is Syria, cut off in a different way. The years of war, meaning that some areas are out of government control, the government itself diplomatically cut off. I mean, by chance, I've came across a warning from the World Food Programme that was issued last week before this earthquake. And it said in Syria at the moment, 90% of people are living in poverty, 3 million are at risk of hunger. And at any stage, 12 million have no idea where the next meal is coming from. This is the situation they were in before that earthquake struck. Now we heard Lise Doucette talking about the diplomatic issues that are behind this. There are some new developments here, but they seem to be contradictory. Earlier this morning, the Syrian Red Crescent announced we will allow aid to all areas of the country, and we will allow United Nations agencies to distribute it, which seemed very good. This suggested these rebel areas, places like Aleppo, badly hit, will be able to access aid. But then the ambassador, the Syrian ambassador to the United Nations said, we will control that aid and where it goes. That, of course, raises the question, will they really allow any aid at all into rebel areas? Areas where, after all, they've tried to destroy the buildings themselves. Why would they care if earthquakes have done that job for them? But crucially, will that aid get in quickly? There is an urgency here. People are exposed, out in the open, in the freezing cold, injured and in need of medical help.
That was Paul Moss. Coming up in this podcast, why do people join extremist groups? Well, a new report from the UN tries to find an answer. Let's turn to Africa now, where Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov is in Mali on his second visit to the continent in the past 2 weeks. Mr. Lavrov's hosts, the military junta, took over power in two successive coups. I asked our senior Africa correspondent Anne Soy about the existing ties between the two countries and what they hope to get out of the visit.
Mali has been cozying up to Russia. We have seen that from around December 2021, they welcomed Russian forces to help fight against extremist militants that have been active in the country. At that time, they had the French forces who had been there for nearly a decade and their allies, a few European countries and American forces, who then withdrew last year because they said that they could not share that space with these fighters from Russia. Now, Mali insists that these fighters are from, you know, the Russian government, but Western officials say that they're actually Wagner mercenaries. And that is why they withdrew for them. Very recently, the US designated the Wagner Group as an international criminal organization. And so they said they will go to neighboring Niger and continue with the fight against extremism there, but they will not share the same space with a group such as Wagner.
So we've got the Wagner Group in there helping out the people who took over power militarily in Mali. So you can understand why perhaps Mali might want to perhaps formalize that relationship with Russia more?
Yeah, that's right, because Mali has been somewhat isolated since the two successive coups of 2020 and 2021. And, you know, the military rulers who are now in charge, they have been isolated in the region. They faced sanctions from the Economic Community of West African Nations, ECOWAS, and internationally as well because of, you know, their dalliance with the Russian forces or Wagner that has led to further isolation. And therefore, this meeting is really a confluence of ambition. On Mali's side, they say to diversify their defense and security ties. And on Russia's side, they have been looking for a foothold in Africa. I think they have found it in Mali. How long that will last, we do not know, because Mali is under pressure to go to elections. They've promised to do elections next year. And so we do not know the fate of the current rulers of the country. So there's a confluence of ambition here.
Anne Soy. Well, as we heard from Anne there, one of the military's justifications for taking power in Mali was to try to overcome Islamist groups there. Over the past decade, support for extremist groups in sub-Saharan Africa has spread and recruitment has spiked. Now, a new United Nations study of the region says the most common factor driving people to join extremist groups is the need for work. Imogen Folks has been reading its findings.
What drives people to join violent extremist groups? Today's report warns that it would be a mistake to assume religion is the key factor. In a number of countries in sub-Saharan Africa, extremist groups are offering what governments can't or won't: social services and livelihoods. But the price is loyalty. Just 17% of those surveyed said religion was a reason for joining. 40% cited poverty.
Imogen Folks. The Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry has formally installed a transition council to prepare for long overdue elections. Haiti has delayed its elections on several occasions following the murder of the former president, Jovenel Moïse, in 2021. The move comes amid a humanitarian crisis and widespread violence from street armed gangs. Our Latin America correspondent Will Grant reports.
This step by Prime Minister Ariel Henry is intended to bring some stability, even a sense of some progress, to the beleaguered Caribbean nation. Haiti has been in the grip of a violent political and social crisis in the wake of the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse 2 years ago. as powerful street gangs have taken control of much of the nation and attempted to force the transitional prime minister from office. In the resulting power vacuum, elections have been repeatedly delayed. The country has been without any elected representatives since early January, and the last presidential vote was in 2016. Formally installing the Transitional Council, made up of three members of Haiti's political, business and civil sectors, Mr. Henri said it was the beginning of the end of dysfunction in Haiti's democratic institutions. The council is tasked with trying to find a viable roadmap towards an election, including choosing members of a provisional electoral authority. Mr. Henri, who has promised to step down in a year's time, said the Transitional Council supported his call for an international rapid reaction force to be deployed in Haiti to tackle the gangs. However, no nation has yet offered to send troops. While Haiti's international partners may applaud Mr. Henri's steps, he faces deep criticism at home and much scepticism that a free and fair election can be held any time soon.
Will Grant. It's being described as a chance in a lifetime. The biggest ever collection of Vermeer paintings is going on show at the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. The exhibition brings together 28 of the 35 or so pieces attributed to the 17th century Dutch master. Anna Holligan reports.
Vermeer is best known for paintings such as The Girl with the Pearl Earring and The Milkmaid, which showcase his signature style of portraying intimate, atmospherically lit domestic scenes. Museums, including the National Gallery in London and the Louvre in Paris, and private owners in seven countries have lent masterpieces to this exhibition. The Rijksmuseum's first Vermeer retrospective has sold more advance tickets than any show in the museum's history.
Anna Holligan. Let's return to our main story and the aftermath of those disastrous earthquakes in Turkey and Syria. Well, Tom Bateman, our Middle East correspondent, has reached Adana, one of the areas hardest hit in southeast Turkey, from where he sent this report.
Across this region, many have suffered war or sought refuge. Now nature has attacked them on more fronts. The earth wrought its carnage as they slept. Now a winter storm has swept in from above. At dawn, as the cold bites in the Turkish city of Adana, a 10-storey building lies collapsed. I meet two women wrapped in blankets heading towards the rubble. They are Umma and Nazife.
Can we walk with you? You're walking to the building now to find relatives.
They're staying in a mosque. Their own building is badly damaged, they tell me.
So we're being moved now because...
Cracks and damage.
Right. A friend with them urges them not to walk close to another tower block. It's cracked, he says. They'll all have to come down.
So we're just walking down side street now, a bit further away from the building. I can see groups of people huddled up on plastic chairs. They're warming their hands around a fire.
Umma and Nazife find their friend, Nurten. She sits and weeps. Her adult daughter was on the second floor of the collapsed building. Nurten has been here all day and all night, but no news comes. Her friends comfort her. Nurten says, she is under the earth. My heart is burning. Her daughter Shinai had two girls of her own, both studying abroad. They're trying to head back today. What am I going to tell the girls? They're coming now. They entrusted their mother to me, she says. Further south, on the border with Syria, is one of the worst-hit Turkish regions, Hatay province. In the darkness, a resident searches the rubble, thinking someone is alive underneath. Speak out loud, he says. The body of one neighbour lies in front of him, but below, he hears a voice cry out. There is a dead man here in the ruins, he says, but nobody has removed him. Now we can hear a woman's voice underneath. The woman cries again and now bangs on metal, trying to hold his attention. But there's nothing he alone can do. An entire home is collapsed, and it will take machinery to lift the ruins. This is a story of unanswered calls being repeated over and over across this region. Not far away, another Hatay resident, Denise, points to the collapsed building where his parents were stranded. "We heard them. They were calling out, asking for help," he cries. "They asked to be rescued. We can't rescue them. How can we rescue them? Nobody has come since the morning. They are alive, but nobody comes." A fire crackles in the city of Karaman Marash, close to the epicentre. There, thousands of buildings are reported collapsed, the number of homeless even higher. A family gathers, too frightened from aftershocks to go back to their badly hit building. The firewood is all they have. "We barely escaped from inside the house," says Nesek Gula. "We have four children. We left the house with them at the last moment. There are several people trapped inside. It is a huge disaster. Now we're waiting without food or water. We're in a desperate state."
Tom Bateman. And that is all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics that we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Javed Gilani and the producer was Tracy Gordon. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
Sporting great, Ora Washington.
Who was Ora Washington?
A born competitor. Ora was champion in two sports.
She was the Michael Jordan of women's basketball.
She was a tennis champion.
But while she was fighting for titles on the courts, she was facing prejudice off them.
The reason is racism and sexism.
Untold Legends, Ora, a podcast from the BBC World Service and BBC Sounds, tells her remarkable story. Search for Untold Legends wherever you found this podcast.